Jonah's Resolve. A sermon delivered on Lord's Day morning, December 14, 1884, by C.H. Spurgeon at the Metropolitan Tabernacle in Newington. Jonah said, "I'm cast out of your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple," Jonah 2, verse 4. What a complex creature is man. Those who fancy that they can fully describe him do not understand him. He is a riddle and a contradiction. As Ralph Erskine wrote, "I'm in mine own and others' eyes a labyrinth of mysteries." Here, for instance, is a confession from David. "So foolish was I, and ignorant. I was as a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You have holden me by my right hand." Psalm 73:22-23. Paul says, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? I thank God, through Jesus Christ our Lord." Romans 7:24-25. He is strengthened with all might by the Spirit of God in the inner man, and yet he is weakness itself. In the text, Jonah appears to be in a despairing condition. "I'm cast out of your sight." And still he has hope, for he resolves, "Yet I will look again toward your holy temple." Everything seems lost, and yet as long as a man can look to God, nothing is lost. God cannot see him. So he thinks, yet he talks about looking towards God. This is singular, is it not? It is as if he said, "I'm cast out of your sight, and yet you are the object of my sight." I do not know of a more gloomy sentence that human lips can speak than this: "I'm cast out of your sight." I do not know of a more hopeful resolution that the human heart can determine upon than this: "Yet I will look again toward your holy temple." O untried and inexperienced brother, be not at all disconcerted when you cannot comprehend yourself. On the contrary, take it as one of the evidences that there is a divine life within you. When you become a mystery to yourself, if like a schoolboy you can draw your own likeness on a slate, with a piece of pencil you can say, "This is all myself," why then, you will be rubbed out, and your image will be forgotten. But an immortal and divinely inhabited spirit which is to survive sun, moon, and stars is not so readily sketched. While you are brother to the worm and akin to corruption, you are nevertheless nearly related to him that sits on the eternal throne. Vast regions of wonderland lie between your condition as the abject prey of death and your portion is an heir of God by Jesus Christ. Manhood is a great deep. I set it not side by side with the fathomless abyss of Godhead, but know of nothing else which surpasses it. Our text next leads me to observe that faith in the child of God, whatever may be his circumstances, still comes to the front. Here is Jonah, in such a wretched condition that he says, "I am cast out of your sight." And yet despite this he declares, "Yet I will look again toward your holy temple." The huge Atlantic waves come rolling on. It sweeps not only over the feet and breast of faith, but it rises far above her head. And for the moment faith seems to be drowned. Wait an instant. And with her face ruddy from the wave and her locks streaming from the flood, faith lifts up her head again and cries, "Yet I will look again toward your holy temple." Faith, motto, rights, invicta, shall ever rise forth upon the white horse, conquering and to conquer. Faith is a child of the omnipotent and shares in his omnipotence. It is born of the eternal, and it possesses the immortality. You may crush and grind it, but every fragment lives. You may cast it into the fire, but it cannot be burned. Neither can the smell of fire pass upon it. You may hurl it into the great deeps, but it is bound to rise again. Faith is an eye that was made to drink in the sunlight. And so long as God is the sun, there will be eyes of faith to rejoice in him. If we have faith, there is that in us which overcomes the world, baffles Satan, conquers sin, rules light, and abolishes death. All things are possible to him that believes. Faith triumphs in every place, notwithstanding that her life is of one continued trial. Offense is broken like a potter's vessel, and reason is frail as a spider's web. But faith abides, and grows, and reigns in the power of the Most High. Please observe, for it may be for the comfort of some here present, that Jonah was in a position altogether unique, and yet faith stood him in good stead. You have read of Joseph in the dungeon, but his imprisonment was nothing compared with the entombment of Jonah in the belly of a fish. You have read of Job on a dunghill, in utter misery. It is a sorry plight, but there are many Jobs and one Jonah, if we reckon by present misery and distress. To lie as a living man, and a living sculptor was horrible. Jonah no doubt suffered from those inconveniences which, apart from miracle, would have ended his life right speedily. A dark, stifling, pestilential cell would have been preferable to the maw of a shark, or whatever great fish it may have been which had swallowed him. The singular thing of it is that he was aware of his position, and knew when the monster dived into the sea bottom, when it passed through a meadow of seaweed, when it neared some great mountain, and when again it arose to the surface. This makes the miracle all the more striking, for one is apt to imagine that the man must have lain dormant, or at least must in a measure have been unconscious while in such singular hiding. His position was such as never mortal man had known before or since. Now it sometimes happens that singularity gives a sting to sorrow. When a man believes that nobody ever suffered as he is doing, he concludes his case to be well nigh hopeless. Dear tried friend, you cannot say this with any certainty, I'm sure, for you have comrades with you in your every grief. But Jonah could say it with absolute truthfulness. He was where never man had been before, and whenever man has been since, to be alive, his trial was all his own. No stranger intermeddled in it. In his affliction he had no predecessor, and no successor. He was the first and the last, that for 3 days and nights had dwelt in the belly of a fish. He was singular to the last degree, and yet, here is the blessedness of it. His faith was equal to his position. You cannot banish faith. Her home is everywhere. You've seen upon a Manx penny the 3 legs, which must always stand, turn a coin whichever way you please. Such is faith. Throw it wherever you may. It always falls on its feet. If faith be in a little child, it gives a child wisdom beyond its years. If it be in a decrepit old man, it makes him strong out of feebleness. If it be faith in solitude, it blesses a man with the best of company. If it be faith in the midst of adversaries, it brings to a man the best of friends. Faith in weakness makes us strong, in poverty makes us rich, and in death makes us live. Get a firm confidence in God, and you don't need inquire what is going to happen. All must be well with you. Winding or straight, uphill or down, or through the fire, or through the sea, if you believe, your road is the King's highway. If faith does not fail, nothing fails. Faith arms a man from head to foot with mail through which neither sword nor spear nor poisoned arrow can ever pierce, though it be forged upon the anvil of the devil's greatest subtlety. No weapon can prosper against you, O true believer. You are as safe as he in whom you believe, for he shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings shall you trust. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. If I might at this time help any child of God who is in trouble, into a solid rest in God. I should be indeed and delighted. Oh, that ever blessed Spirit would help me to that end. Carefully note, first, the verdict of sins, I'm cast out of your sight. And secondly, the resolve of faith, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. These, remember, were both found in one man, at one time, one, first. Here's the verdict of sins. Please notice that it comes first in the text. Sense hurriedly decides, I'm cast out of your sight. It is noteworthy that unbelief is always first to speak. Wherever David observes, I said in my haste, you will notice that something is to be confessed which was unwise and untrue. Unbelief cannot wait. It must have its say. It blabs out all its silly soul at its earliest opportunity. In your own case, if you can be calm and patient, you will speak to God's glory. But if you are hasty and petulant, and must needs talk as soon as ever the trial comes upon you, it is almost an absolute certainty that you will say what you will be glad to unsay. Our hasty words are often dipped in wormwood and handed back to us that we may eat them. Hold still a while, brother. Or if you must speak to your God and not against him. Speak to your God and not to yourself. Soliloquies are frequently an increase of woe. The heart ferments and heats itself, creating an inward fever which parches the soul. If a vessel lacks vent, it is not helped by being stirred within itself. Yet, such is the case when we say with David, I pour out my soul in me. Better is that word, you people. Pour out your heart before him, even before the living God. Brother, speak thou not to yourself, lest you seem to be a madman. You may vex your soul exceedingly by those lone maunderings. Speak to God. Even if you utter hasty words, in words of unbelief, they are better uttered in his presence than muttered within your own heart. He will hear them in any case. But when he perceives that in your spirit there is no guile, though much impatience, he will freely forgive you all your childish error of too hasty speech and help you to bear up under your woe. Speak, for silence slays, but speak to God, for he is full of compassion. Take the warning of the text, however, and be slow to murmur, remembering that the carnal nature is ever swift to speak. And sure to speak amiss. This verdict of sense in the next place was apparently very correct. I said, I am cast out of your sight. Did it not seem so? Jonah had tried to get away from God, and God had pursued him with a tempest, and almost broken the ship to pieces in order to be at him. As a result of the tempest, he had been hurled into the sea, and in the sea a great fish had swallowed him. And he had been carried down till the floods compassed him about. Did not all his surroundings confirm his suspicion that he was a castaway? Could he expect ever again that the word of the Lord would come to Jonah the son of Amittai? Could he hope ever again to stand with a joyful multitude that kept holy day in the courts of the Lord's house, or to present his sacrifice of thanksgiving upon Jehovah's altar? No. If he judged by his feelings, he was shut up to the conclusion which he expressed. To remain nothing to him but bare life, and that in such a condition that one could hardly desire to have it continued, he reckoned, with abundant show of reason, that he must be cast out of God's sight. Yet it was not so, and therefore I invite those of you who have begun to judge your God by what you feel and by what you see, to revise your judgment, and in future to be very diffident as to your power to come to any just conclusion as to God's dealings with you. Thank God you will be wrong if you despair. It is much better for you to show your faith by relying on your God than to display your folly by saying, I am cast out. As this verdict of sin seemed to be correct, Jonah must have felt that it was assuredly deserved. If the Lord had dealt with Jonah according to his sins, he would have been a castaway. He had hurried to Joppa and taken a passage in a ship to go to Tarshish and anywhere else to flee from the presence of God. Now, what was a fitter punishment for him than that he should be cast out from the sight of God? Had not this been his inquiry at Joppa? Where shall I go from your spirit? Was it not this his demand? Where shall I flee from your presence? Now he has his answer. He is carried down till the depth clothed him round about. His waywardness had come home to him. He had been paid in his own coin. And what could Jonah feel but that he was filled with his own ways? Had he died in the sea, he could not have doubted the Lord's justice. If he had been driven away as an outcast, it had been but righteous retribution to a runaway who refused his master's service. This must have made him doubly sorrowful. A guilty conscience is the source, the ingredient of all. When each where howled in Jonah's ear, "You deserve it." He was in an evil plight indeed. One sharp part of Jonah's misery was that God's hand was so evidently in his misery. He sees it and trembles. Observe how he ascribes all to God. "You have cast me into the deep, in the midst of the seas, and the floods compass me about. All your billows and your waves pass over me." We can bear a blow from an enemy, but a wound from our best friend is hard. If the Lord himself go forth against us, the war is one to tremble at. If the messenger of grief be commissioned by Jehovah himself, and we know it, mere carnal reason concludes that all is over finally, and that henceforth all we can do is to sit down and die. Faith doesn't think so. But this is after all the manner of flesh and sense. Observe that this verdict of sins, "I am cast out from God," was very bitter to Jonah. You can see by the way in which he speaks that it is a very heavy burden to him, and yet it seems strange that it should be so. Here is a man who, when he was in a wrong state of heart, sought to flee from the presence of the Lord, and therefore went to the sea coast on purpose, rejoiced to find a ship bound for a distant and almost unknown land, and paid the fare to sail in it, of set purpose, that he might flee away from God. And now that he thinks he is away from God, he is filled with horror and dismay. By this we know the children of God, even at their worst estate. O you that are the people of God, you may sometimes in your willfulness wish that you could get away from the all-searching eye. But if you could do so, it would be hell to you. If you are a child of God, you must dwell in the presence of God. It is your life, and you cannot be happy anywhere else. Oh, redeemed, regenerate man, it is impossible now for your once renewed spirit ever to be happy in the beggarly elements of your former condition, except in the divine atmosphere of heavenly love. There is no rest for you. You are spoiled for this world. O heir of the world to come, there was a time when its dainties would have been sweet to your taste, and your soul could have been filled with them. But that day is over now. You must eat the bread of heaven or starve. If you are not happy in your God, you are doomed to be happy nowhere. There is no choice left for you. Your very nature is so affected now that as a needle rests, not save at its point to the pole, so can your heart never be quiet except in Jesus. The light of his countenance must be light to you, or you must walk in darkness. Your music must come from Jesus' lips, or else there is nothing for you but wailing and gnashing of teeth. Your heaven must be in his embrace. There is no heaven elsewhere for you, nor would we wish to have it different. I'm sure I can say from my very soul that if God could leave me, it would be to me a hell worse than Dante or Milton could imagine. What if I had to pursue my holy calling and to preach? What? Woe to preach without him. What a hollow mockery. If I were bound to continue still the outward form of prayer and of a moral life, what vanity of vanities would it all be without my Lord, without God, brothers, sisters? Can you bear the thought? Is it not the pang of hell, nor its fires, nor its undying worm, nor aught else that can be pictured of the amazing terror that causes such alarm? Is a bare thought of being severed from God, to be cast out from his sight, were hell indeed. Now I should think that if Jonah has been in a calm state of mind, and had been able to consider things in the light of truth, it ought to have given him some ground of hope that he was not cast out from God after all, because he was so unhappy at the idea of being so cast out. Will the Lord leave a soul that is distressed by such heaving? No spirit is wholly cast off from God if it longs after God. If you can be content without God, you are indeed a lost one. But if there be in you a wretched, rankling discontent at the very thought of being severed from your God, then you are his, and he is yours, and no eternal division shall come between you and him.